This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and you're listening to a very special episode. This is Shireen Gourvani on the left.
And John Dougal on the right.
And we
are unsupervised.
It's true. Natalie's schedule would not allow her to be with us.
She sends her regards, but she was not here.
But I have to say, one thing that I loved is we got a couple of emails from listeners. Always good to hear from you. Some really good ideas about one really great suggestion I'm going to work on for a special episode, reaching out to the folks at MWEG to see if they would sit down. And then another listener that took issue with you and Natalie describing marijuana as a gateway drug, I decided to let that one slide because I do think it's a bit of an antiquated issue. But the listener wrote in and said, you know, we talk about marijuana as a gateway drug because of the way that we force people to access it. And I don't think that that's entirely untrue, right? So if it were regulated, if it were in dispensaries, the experience would be different than, for example, trying to find a drug dealer.
It's okay. I think alcohol is a gateway drug. I think tobacco is a gateway drug. So, you know.
Yeah.
That's the world I come from.
Well, okay. So I don't know how to transition smoothly from gateway drugs to, let's just say, ongoing.
The Strait of Hormuz? Is that where we're going?
No, I was going to say just the ongoing chaos, really, from this administration. It doesn't appear that there's any end in sight in the war with Iran. What are you seeing, John? What are you thinking about when you look at this or hear the news?
Well, I think what I keep seeing is, okay, we have a deal. No, we don't have a deal. We have a deal. We're almost there. The deal is to have 60 days to make a deal. And so you have a bunch of Republicans that are really divided. There are those that didn't want to be in a war in the Middle East, and they're frustrated. Why are we in this thing? And there's others that are saying, you know, this is a president that he's had the courage that others haven't had for 47 years. Just give him some time, and we're going to get a great deal out of this. And I think, unfortunately for Trump, he's looking going, okay, I don't have a deal that's good that I can settle on. So we got to keep churning this thing until we get something that is, if you will, better than Obama.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the questions about enriched uranium, I think going all the way back, and I don't mean to sound too conspiratorial, but it's sure been a pleasant distraction from the Epstein files, which he appears in thousands and thousands of times. I think that it continues to be a distraction from the grift of this presidency, from the corruption of this presidency, the self-dealing. And it is something that is, when you say Republicans, do you mean Republicans in office? Do you mean kind of everyday Republicans? Because it seems there's a real divide there, too, between the Senate and then everyday people.
I'm talking everyday Republicans.
Yeah.
There are folks that view themselves as MAGA going, I don't see this as MAGA. And there's others that are pro-Trump through and through, regardless essentially of what he does. And so they're willing to ride with whatever this issue is.
Yeah.
But you talk about, do presidents use other international issues to distract from certain, you know, domestic issues? Yeah, well, you go back to Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky,
and
the bombing that took place to distract from that scandal. And so, I don't know what's taking place, but clearly we are not getting to a quick resolution in the Middle East like so many hoped. Like this would be like Venezuela.
Right.
We're in and out within a couple of days and we're done and we move on and we have peace there for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't see that happening. The other thing that we see happening is just a very real impact on Utahns' pocketbooks. We know that people are dipping into savings. People are certainly seeing the pain of this at the gas pump.
And that flows through all sorts of
the
items
entire
that we
economy,
purchase.
Correct. And, you know, we're starting to hear folks from the administration saying that these costs, we're not going to see $3 a gallon gas again for 4 or 5 years, just looking at the futures and the fact that we still haven't.
That statement is a shocking statement because I think a lot of folks were thinking, okay, in the next couple months, it's going to go back to where it was before.
Yeah. So I have to ask you, you know, we're seeing Trump polling numbers abysmal. Around 37% is the most recent in, I believe, the New York Times Siena poll. Numbers that low, you know, certainly Biden at the end of the last administration. But I would also say it's reminiscent for me of George W. Bush. When we think about the way that people were experiencing exploding costs, inflation, when we think about what was happening engaged in Iraq, and his numbers dropped down into the 20s. Do you think that's the glide path that Trump is on?
I can't speak to that. I mean, you can look at Ronald Reagan. I don't know what his exact poll numbers were, but in the early 80s, he was fairly unpopular because he was fighting inflation. And yet, in hindsight, people look back and go, okay, that worked out. He fixed that problem. We benefited from that for decades. And so, you know, that was a good price to pay. And it was good that he took that leadership.
Yeah.
I think it's fair for folks to question whether we're in that same position today.
Yeah,
if we get through the war and other things like that, people will look back and say, okay, it was the price to pay. It was a good decision. But maybe, it's still too early to decide right now.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, it seems that our president is a bit distracted. So I've heard him talk numerous times about the American flag blue that will be going in the reflecting pool ahead of the 250th celebration of this country. And
elaborate a little bit more.
You know,
what?
So what we're talking about is, I would say, sort of the gildification of Washington, D.C. There are reports that he is taking money from the national parks fees to wants to cover some of the statues around Washington, D.C. In gold, doing a draining and painting of the reflecting pool so that it is.
Well, the reflecting pool needs to get fixed. I understand it's had issues for
a while.
At least
yeah,
a decade.
Yeah. And then also we're seeing the infrastructure for a UFC wrestling fight go up on the White House lawn. When you think about the kind of everyday pain,
this is the fallback from a ballroom. Is that what you're alluding to?
I mean, the ballroom as well continues to move forward. But when we think about, you know, the fact that thousands of Utahns at this point have lost access to health care because of the Big Beautiful Bill, which was basically a promise to President Trump to continue to fund his tax cuts for the wealthy. When we think about the cost of gas, right? When we think about the very real challenges that Utahns are facing, whether it's around a slowing economy, all of those things. The focus that our president and dedication that he seems to have on this 250th is really something. What are your perceptions of what's going on in Washington?
Well, I'm going to go back. Whether you want to talk Big Beautiful Bill or something else. I mean, the simple fact from my perspective is taxes are too high. Federal taxes are too high. And so we need to be cutting that. But we also need to be cutting the government. And you know, I hate deficits. I hate debt. And we need to be shrinking, eliminating the deficits and shrinking the debt.
Very much moving in the wrong direction.
And so we're moving in the wrong direction there. But in terms of cutting taxes, there are various taxes I think are good policy, which should have been done. Clearly, there's a bunch of other tax policy that's throwing in there that I don't think was good and wise to put in there.
So tell me about the 250th. What do you think?
250th. This is one of those things I can remember a little bit because I was 10, 1976, so 200 years, and we were celebrating. So I can remember a little bit of the festivities and stuff. And,
yeah.
And it seemed nice to reminisce about, you know, 200 years from the founding. Right now, I think there's a lot of folks that are, you know, concerned that there's too much focus on the president, not enough on
the country.
America and the country and 250th and this distracting from the broader celebration across our nation.
Yeah. So I think that's right. It does seem like this has become very much about Trump, who has a birthday coming up as well. So it's his 80th birthday on Flag Day, happens to be Flag Day, June 14th. And he is having a hard time keeping the talent that they have booked for this. It sounds like people didn't exactly understand what they were signing up for.
It sounded like folks were signing up for a nonpartisan kind of celebration, and then turned out it was more, you know, Trump was in control and command.
Do you know what's happening here locally? I mean, it sounds like there are a number of celebrations here, and I do hope that they have that kind of flavor of what you're talking about, that sort of sense of being part of something bigger. But there, I would just say that I know that there are many things scheduled across this entire state. I hope that people can find something and a way to engage. But I also understand that it's a time that feels fraught to celebrate where we're headed as a nation.
Well, for some, they're going to look and say, you know, this grand experiment, we're 250 years in, and look at what we've accomplished and where we've gone. There are others that are clearly going to say, you know, the experiment isn't working so well, and they're going to question the future direction.
Yeah.
And question how much longer we can go. And,
yeah.
and that's a key challenge, not just as America, but, you know, relative to China and others, you know, what is the vitality of our economy, the strength of the American dream? And I think the American dream is powerful.
Yeah,
we need to focus on that. We shouldn't be distracted by any one individual and focus on this broader collective of where we've come from, the legacy that was laid out for us, and our opportunity to lead to a better future.
Yeah, I really agree with you there. I will say something else I think that's probably good not to focus on if we want to think about positive items is really how dysfunctional our Congress continues to seem to be. So two things caught my eye. GOP leaders delayed a vote on Iran War Powers resolution until June. So just kicking that down the road. This is something that I think historically, for example, our Senator Mike Lee would have been very aggressive about suggesting that we need. But it does seem that he is also a person who's interested in maybe not taking that vote.
Sometimes we get too selective of who the president is.
Don't we?
We play, like I've said, team R, team D. Depends.
Yeah.
If Joe Biden, Barack Obama's in office, then, you know.
Then suddenly Mike Lee cares.
Mike Lee cares, and the Democrats don't care. And then you flip it the other way around, and then, you know, the parties change, and what they lobby for, champion, all of a sudden flips.
It's not a good look. And then
that's
we
why
also
I tell
have...
folks always, whenever it comes to policy, take a name out and just put the other opposition party's name in there and ask yourself, is it a good idea or not?
Is it a good idea? Yeah.
If you think it's a good idea for Trump, do you think it's a good idea for Joe Biden?
Right. The Senate also delayed a vote on ICE funding as the GOP really revolts over Trump's ballroom. And in particular, and I know we said the $1.8 billion, but technically it is...
1776
million slush fund, which is really a opportunity for people who feel like they've been aggrieved or unnecessarily attacked by the government to receive some sort of restitution. Now, these are people who attacked police officers on the Capitol during January 6th.
Well, there's a couple officers, Capitol police officers, who have sued to block this because they're saying if somebody who was part of attacking the Capitol, breaking in, attacking Capitol Police are getting any of this money, they think that's reprehensible and that should not happen. And so they sued to block that.
Yeah, well, it seems that somebody else who thinks this is reprehensible is actually our other senator, John Curtis, who has said that there is nothing to like about it. And I really am proud of him for speaking out about this. This seems easy to me, but unfortunately, we're not hearing similar calls for clarity.
Well, here's what I hate is the Republicans are taking from the Democrats' playbook. Mm-hmm. Too often it was sue and settle, sue and settle. When it came to environmental issues, other things like that, it was this game of we're going to sue, but we got a friendly party on the other side. They're going to settle and we're going to benefit from that. And so that's what I hate. One of the key things I hate here is this is Republicans playing that same game, sue and settle with a friendly administration.
Yeah, we don't like to see it. Well, this is Shireen Gourbani, and I am with John Dougal, and you are listening to a very special unsupervised edition of Both Sides of the Aisle, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We'd love to hear from our listeners like you. If you'd like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And this is a...
unsupervised version.
It's true.
Natalie couldn't make it.
She couldn't make it today, but we wanted to make sure
Can
that we were...
Can you believe they trust us?
I know.
Just you and I.
I think it's very... I hope, listeners, that you don't mind. We know that it's nice when Natalie's here to referee a little bit. And also, I think that... I do often think that her politics probably... catch a large cross-section of our listeners. Uh-huh. If you're feeling
those that
unrepresented...
Think you're too far one way and I'm too far the other, and she's right there in the middle. Right. So.
Well, anyway.
But it's hard to coordinate three people's schedule, especially as we get into
summer.
You know, summer.
Yeah, well, thank you for sticking with us, and thank you for listening. So a number of things that we could start
off
here.
Postmortem?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
Why did the Democrats lose the presidential election?
Well,
they researched this and researched this and put out a report.
We don't know is the answer. It's many things.
Oh, we know. We just don't want to admit.
Well, it's many, many things, I think, is the issue. So this is quite the ordeal inside of the Democrats.
Joe Biden said Joe had a stroke. It's not that.
Well, let's get into it. So basically what happened is... after the loss, so Biden loses. Well, Biden drops out. Kamala Harris comes
doesn't
in.
Doesn't run.
Yeah,
for re-election,
doesn't win. And then what is actually very typical, and Republicans do this after a big loss, Democrats do it after a big loss, is what's considered a postmortem, where they really do go around the country. And the idea is that they're engaging in focus groups, really ideally in swing states, but often everywhere, to understand, you know, what people's perceptions were of what happened and how things went. Now, what was interesting about this is that in particular, the DNC chair, so the Democratic National Committee chair, Ken Martin, promised when he ran for the chair that he would release the report. He would let people know what had been found in this autopsy of the post-election aftermath. And he said, well, we released the learnings. We released the lessons from it. And a lot of people, I would say, on the progressive left, on the left in general, in political circles, said, that's not enough. Like, we want the full report. Well, then something unusual happened. Ken Martin ran into one of the guys at Pod Save America at some event in D.C. and said, I'd love to come on the show and talk about it. So he did. And he was asked point blank, why have you not released this report? And the answers were infuriating. I think if you were just any person who's listening to somebody bob and weave in a way that was just not done very artfully. It just felt like a con. Like, I just wanted to say, just tell us what happened. Well, then on the day, frankly, that the Republicans announced that, well, the Trump administration announced the slush fund to repay people who stormed our Capitol during January 6th, and just a number of terrible things that the Trump administration was doing, Democrats, kind of in true form, put the report out. And it is a disaster.
Under the cover of lots of other distractions.
Well, you would think, but I mean, it really took up space because of truly how magnificently poorly executed it was. It was incomplete. It wasn't fact-checked. It wasn't, I think, in any possible world, it would not meet muster. And Martin did come out and say, released a statement saying, here it is in its full horror, and went on to say, it didn't meet my standards. This is not, you know, a complete report. And I think, why the months? Why the months of sitting on something? You could have just said that. This is not what, this
they,
does not
they
mean.
They knew it was bad and they didn't want to release it.
But more than that, it wasn't just bad. It was poorly, so the feedback wasn't good, but also it was poorly executed. And I think, as a person who is very concerned in particular about the way that there was, I think, a total mishandling, and we continue to see just unbelievable violence directed towards Palestinians, there was no mention of Gaza in the report at all. So that wasn't even an area that was explored. Right. So when you think about.
So to what extent, I'm going to walk back because I haven't read the report.
Oh,
I've just read various things about it. But what I heard is it really didn't even touch on Joe Biden and his issues and the debate performance that was abysmal that all of America watched. And I understood it didn't even touch on that type of thing.
It didn't.
And this is where I look at these postmortems, and it's people don't want to be honest.
No.
It doesn't matter if it's. In this case, it's the Democrats, the Republicans. They just don't truly want to lay out what the issues are, because then they'll have to point fingers to say, okay, this didn't go well. We didn't fess up to that. You know, when you watch Joe Biden melt down on a debate stage.
Oh, yeah.
And then you pretend like he's capable, and Joe Biden has come out and said, I was fearful that he was having a stroke.
Jill Biden. Yeah, Joe
Sorry,
Biden.
Joe Biden. About Joe Biden, that Joe was having a stroke. Well, and then she takes him to the Waffle House afterwards. This is not what you do when somebody's having a stroke.
It
makes no sense. And then when the Democrats didn't call for him to step down from office because of his health issues, this is where it's like the American people look at that and go, you guys are covering up. And then you see this that doesn't even touch on it.
Yeah. And I think that's, for me, at the core of this. A lot of people, I mean, this is pretty inside, you know, inside baseball. But I think that there's a real, it's an indication, it's a symptom of a broader issue. And it's this issue of not wanting to be honest with ourselves about where we are or where we're going. And I certainly see that on the right. I mean, I'm not, you know, I think you often are like, oh, it's a both sides issue. I really do think it's a both sides issue. I think if we can step back and be honest about what the second rise of Donald Trump means to a Republican Party, it's grim. Like, it's not good. You know, what is actually going on inside of our politics and inside of our country that allows that? Something is fundamentally wrong. To look at what happened with the end of the Biden presidency, him not, the people around him encouraging him to stay in the race, the frankly absolute, I think Kamala Harris, given the circumstances, did a pretty good job. That was a terrible circumstance to be put in with 100 days to go to the election.
With Joe putting his thumb on the scale in her favor.
In her favor.
Because somebody else might have done
better. The entire situation was so poorly managed, and I do think it is an indictment of our broader politic. But anyway, thanks for letting me get into it. I was pretty upset about it. So
how do you really feel?
Yeah, I know. Turning to another issue that is something I feel really passionately about is this issue around, I know this is a strange pivot, but long-term care and aging Americans. So this is something that I think is, you know, something you've personally had to deal with aging parents who are looking for safe places to be. I think many Americans find themselves really stuck in this situation. But really, the problem is that most seniors can't afford long-term care. 70% of them are going to need it before they die. And the average person who turns 65 will eventually incur around $130,000 in long-term care costs. And that's according to the Bipartisan Policy Center analysis. I think that might even be low. Tell me a little bit about even just your own experience with this.
So I have four parents, you know, my parents and my in-laws that are all in their 80s and all in different states of health condition, stuff like that. Unfortunately, tragically, my father-in-law got hit by a car on Thursday and fell and broke his hip. And so we're now dealing with that. But he was the caregiver for my mother-in-law. So now the family's rallying to try and wrestle with that. And then you've got, you know, my parents that are aging. And so it's where do you have assisted, you know, independent living or assisted living facilities, so forth, to help them at different states along the way? What are the costs? How does family come in? For a lot of Americans, their parents live in different places than they are. Yeah. I've got a large, you know, family, you know, 11 brothers. Well, there's me. Yeah. So there's 11 kids, 10 brothers and sisters. And so we can all jump in different ways to try and help care for our parents. Some of us are local, some are remote. But for other folks, there's only one or two kids, if any, and they may live on the other side of the country.
Right.
And how do you reach out? How do you help? I've got a friend, and she flies out across the country to state in the South a couple times a year to help out, but is not there day in and day out. My parents are, you know, 6 miles away from me, so right. I can be there every day if I need to.
Right, right. And I mean, what we know is that the private market for long-term care insurance has largely collapsed, right? So only about 3% of people over 50 hold policies. This is categorically...
And we think the government's taking care of it. A lot of people think Medicare is going to cover it, and Medicare doesn't cover certain long-term care.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So it's a mix of Medicare and Medicaid that usually is involved if you're if you are lucky enough to even have access to a facility like this. But this is something Democrats are getting really focused on and trying to understand as we have an aging population, especially folks who have had fewer children. What are the policy answers here? And I'm just wondering, when you kind of think high level about it, what do you think?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So I have a few ideas. I mean, I think this is a place where we have seen a market collapse, right? And it's a similar thing, and not dissimilar, I think, in some ways from childcare, where the cost is high to have this kind of care in our society. The workforce is limited and needs to be paid. It's a tough job on either end of the spectrum. And we need folks who are focused on, you know, a healthcare background, especially for that elder care, and finding folks who want to work in that environment when they can work in, you know, in a hospital often and make more and have less, you know, stress. It feels like a market challenged environment. So I do think this is a place where we have to have really strategic and smart government investment.
I'm going to say I don't think it's a market collapse, but it's a market challenge. I agree with you, because historically, I think it was viewed as the kids take care of their parents.
Yeah.
And we have shifted in that. And now we've got folks living longer. And so we're trying to figure out, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Now, I know for you and others, it may be we need more government involvement. The concern I have there is we get really rigid, we get really bureaucratic, and we drive up the costs even more.
Yeah.
And we don't think of the total cost of care. Right now, I see some of the dynamics with Medicare for my dad, and it's like they're paying for this, that, and the other. And I'm like, we would not normally just be paying for that. And yet the government is flushing this money out.
Yeah.
In some cases where I'm going, I don't think that's a wise expenditure.
Yeah. I will say this is a place where if you're not a person who's kind of closely following private equity plays a big role in nursing homes and in aging facilities around this country. And so I would just say that's another place where my concern about what you're expressing is happening exactly on the other side, right? So the exploitation of folks who are really vulnerable here in circumstances where they are not well regulated and they are not safe environments. And frankly,
it may not be well supervised.
Right, exactly. And
you talk about private equity, but we've seen even situations here in Utah where certain rural hospitals have started acquiring networks of nursing homes.
Yeah.
And taking some of the money out of it, so the care has gone down as a result.
Yeah, waste, fraud, and abuse. So would love to see that actually addressed in this country. So there is of course, we continue to see a lot of news about the data center in Box Elder, reporting now that Governor Cox knew about this far before he sort of indicated that he did, that meetings had been happening, conversations had been happening around the start of the year. I also have to say, I noticed that the person in your former role, a state auditor, has put up a website to try to answer some of these questions. This is really, or not specifically about Cox's involvement, but about what MIDA is.
MIDA.
Can you just kind of talk about the efforts around transparency?
Yeah, so one of the key tools for auditors to make things transparent, especially from a financial perspective. And so that was one of the things I worked really hard on. And as Auditor Cannon was running, One of the things I was pushing her on is to double down and do even better when it comes to transparency. And so she issued some information to help folks better understand what MITA is, how it works, where the money goes, what projects they're overseeing.
So you can go to Search Our Auditor and you will be able to find this website, and hopefully people can start to get some answers. But this is Shireen Gorbani and I'm here with John Dougal. You have been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Our producer is Anthony Scoma, and we thank you so much for listening.